Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. I tried not to raise my hands above my head and still failed. Laughing at me for that failure is Ryan Bailey. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Tate. I'm sorry, it's a very visual joke for an audio medium, but every time you start the show, you put your arms in the air, and it just reminds me of when you're on a roller coaster and like the thing comes down, the support yeah. thing comes down. And I do it too, out of habit now. Yeah. I love it.
See, are you actually able to keep your hands above your head? Because I still have that little like voice in the back of my head saying, you know, the bar could come up. You could go flying out of this roller coaster, and then the arms sort of go down every now and then. I would love to be the one who can keep them up the whole time. I don't always succeed. Are you able to do that?
Danger's my middle name, baby.
I can tell by the running snood, the backwards hat. He's a dangerous man, Ryan Bailey. That's what I've always said, and what everyone has always said.
I have been running on the mean streets of South Charlotte today, yes, it's terrifying out there. I mean, it's not as seditious as some other streets around this country, but I've got to keep my eyes about me out here.
Is your first studio album going to be called On the Streets of South Charlotte?
My first? Taylor, you've not been following my career. I'm on like number 7 now.
My apologies. I do apologize. I don't celebrate the entire Ryan Bailey discography. Have you recorded stuff? Do you have a place where people can hear you sing songs that isn't in the Metro Charlotte area?
I do. I have a SoundCloud.
I didn't know.
But we're not here to discuss that, though, Tay-Tay. We're not here to discuss
that. But next show we will be. Next show we will be, my friend. Until then, we are here to discuss some listener questions. We've got 7 or so, last I counted. We're going to start with one from Patrick Delaney. There's a popular phrase on foot soccer ball Twitter: the streets won't forget. It's about a player who was great for a short period of time, such as the streets won't forget Adel Terapt. Who is your favorite the streets won't forget player is the question. But before we get to that question, Ryan, were you familiar with this phrase? Because I will admit that I was not.
I had to look it up. I did not know it. I'm sorry. I'm an old person. I apologize.
I did, and then I think I saw like where it might come from, and then I felt even older and, to be honest, whiter. So, yes, I'm glad that we're on the same page when it comes to not being familiar with the slang of the children. I don't know how old Patrick Delaney is. He may well be older than both of us.
I do have different reference points, and the Streets are a very popular sort of urban music collective from the UK. So when I first saw the Streets Won't Forget, I was thinking, is it Mike Skinner from the Streets who's not forgetting something?
So I had the same thing. I was like, Fit But You Know It? Like, is that what we're talking about? A Grand Old Come For Free? I guess that is sort of the Streets Not Forgetting.
Did the Streets come out here, or is that specialist knowledge of yours?
That might be specialist knowledge, because my brother works in a record store and knew that I was into, like, football and the hip-hop, so maybe that was it. I didn't know it was a collective. I always thought it was just Mike Skinner's performing name.
Yeah, I said collective. He does collaborate, but it's mainly just him. Yeah.
I see.
I misspoke.
So if you want to hear a person rap about their emotions and be British, Mike Skinner, The Streets is for you. But in terms of players that The Streets will not forget, Ryan, who are some that you had?
I've got a few. I'm going to start off with one that's The Streets will not forget, but only if those streets were walked by someone in their mid to late 30s or beyond, because that's what I am. And I keep mentioning in this show how old I am. I apologize for ramming that down your throats. But my one is a mid-90s player. I don't know how many people have heard of him. Played for Tottenham. He was a winger from Portugal. José Domínguez. Does the name mean anything to you?
It does not. To the extent that I thought you were setting up it was going to be a very well-known name. No, that name does not ring a bell, I will admit.
So mid-90s Tottenham had some decent players. They had David Gilla and players like sort of some flair players, one of whom was José Domínguez, who was from Lisbon. I think he played at Sporting before he came to Tottenham. But he was a tiny, tiny man. I think his Wikipedia said he was 5'5". I could believe he was shorter than that. But like had the 90s curtains thing going on as a hairstyle, and was just a really, really creative and fancy player. I went to a reserve game, Wimbledon against Tottenham, which had about 3 people and their dogs watching it one rainy Tuesday. And José Domínguez was coming back from injury, so they would often play players like that in the reserves to get them back up to speed. And he was maybe 20 or 30 times better than every other player on the field. It was insane. It was like men against boys. And if you go on YouTube and check him out, José Domínguez, he's got some really sort of awesome goals that he scored as well. And he's a name that nobody really knows anymore. Tottenham fans will probably know him, but no one else really does. So he was a decent Premier League player who was only there in a flash. I think he probably only played a couple of seasons. He fell out of favour at Tottenham, I think, with George Graham. So, a bit of a flash in the pan. And I've just looked it up. He's 46 years old now. Goodness me.
Wow. But the streets of North London will not forget him?
A some streets, yeah, I say. It depends. If it's these kids who... The kids who have invented the phrase, the streets won't forget, they might have forgotten if they ever knew.
I have gone... I don't have anybody from that far back. I think the furthest back I'm going is like the late 2000s, because I'm going to start with Amir Zaki from Wigan. Remember Amir Zaki?
Oh, good one.
Yeah. Who, like, came in, I think had a reputation in Egypt for the Egyptian national team, and then for, I forget which club it was. I'm going to guess Al Ahly, but fans will not love if I got that wrong, since they tend to not like each other. But he comes to Wigan and cannot stop scoring in his first few games. I think scores in every single one of his first 7 games, similar to Erling Haaland. I think midway through the season was third top scorer in the Premier League, and then did not score again for the rest of the season. Fell out spectacularly with Steve Bruce, was referred to as one of the least professional players Bruce had ever encountered. Fines, all of this stuff, none of it mattered. It was on a 1-year loan he came, and that 1-year loan was not picked up. It was not made permanent despite him scoring those goals, but it was this player who sort of couldn't stop scoring. The hype train was about him. I remember listening to Football Weekly and they were like, who is this guy? It's amazing. It's so cool. And then nothing. So I think the streets of Wigan, if there are streets there, will remember him quite well. And that's one that stood out for me.
There are streets in Wigan. I can confirm that.
Okay. Cool.
That's a good one. That's reminded me of Mido, who was a fellow Egyptian at Tottenham and Middlesbrough, I want to say, who was sort of very flash in the pan as well. But he
liked things cooked in a pan. That's what I would say about Mido.
Exactly. Yeah. He got heavier and not in status. I'll say that. Can I, on that kind of early 2000s note, can I have JJ Okocha? Is that a streets won't forget, or is he too well known?
For me, he's one of my favorite players. So for me, I'm probably a bad person to ask. But that was the only like flair move I could pull off as a teenager was the Okocha move. So that's why he looms large for me. But maybe not for other folk. Why does he loom large for you?
Just because he was just he epitomized that Bolton team for me. Mm-hmm. It was that Bolton period where he was there, and he's still a fan favorite. I think Bolton fans still talk about him. And he scored. Was it against West Ham? He scored like some ridiculous goal, which is like Bolton's greatest goal ever. They still hold it up in high regard. But this was a period of Bolton where they had Yuri Djorkaeff and they had like Ivan Campo and all these really high class players, like World Cup winners, coming to Bolton, which felt so wildly unlikely. This was not long after they moved to what was then the Reebok Stadium, their new sort of fancy stadium on the outskirts of Manchester, having come from a more humble ground previously. And they became this sort of, Sam Allardyce is steering this team towards the top 10. They finished eighth, I think, in 2003-04. And then things have started to go slightly wrong since then. It turns out if you pump all that money in and you don't sort of have good financial planning, it can lead you towards the brink of financial disaster, as Bolton discovered around 10 years later, and they're sort of not doing so well at the moment. But hey, they had fun with JJ.
They did. I'm also glad you brought up Ivan Campo, because I still get him confused with Ivan Cavallero. And then I'm like, how is he still playing and looking as good as he does? So... yes, Ivan Campo, a different player than Ivan Cavallero, for sure. That's a good shout.
I saw Ivan Campo at the airport once. It was very exciting. His hair was big.
I imagine. I've got a few more. Quick one would be the combo. I saw this posted elsewhere. I am lifting it, but it does loom large. The Demba Ba, Papisse, Demba Cisse, I believe it was. 29 goals between them playing for Newcastle. That was like, I think Papisse Dembélé scoring with the outside of a foot from like zero angle, and you kind of had to watch Newcastle, or at least watch the Match of the Day highlights, because you could always kind of count on one of them to score some sort of ridiculous goal. Then that doesn't end up being a long-lasting partnership, to say the least. More recently, one that like immediately came to mind once I realized what this phrase was about would be Dimitri Payet moving to West Ham. Like, being this performer for West Ham, I remember at Euro 2016 when he comes on and scores, and Slaven Bilic, who was then his manager at West Ham, doing like TV analysis, was like celebrating, like, see, I told you, vindication, this guy's going to come good. Then he has phantom back pain and forces a move back to France. But for that one season, for that like that brief period in England, he was this unplayable player for a club that you usually don't associate with unplayable players.
I like it. I like it a lot. And by the way, Taylor, I'm surprised, as a Manchester United fan, that two words have not passed your lips. One is Federico.
Okay. And the other one would be Makeda. I thought about him. I went for Adnan Januzaj instead, because that was one who, like, when he first comes into the squad with David Moyes, he's like the lone bright spot that season, scoring goals, flicks and tricks, and it's like, okay, maybe it's the new Ronaldo, and he's a multinational winger who could do so many different things. And then basically the thing he did was follow David Moyes to different clubs, follows him to Sunderland, follows him to Real Sociedad, where he remains. But that was a player who I was sure was the next Ronaldo. Sort of justified the hope very briefly, or the hype very briefly, and then fell off. I had him a little bit ahead of Makeda just because I think Makeda was a bit more flash in the pan. Giannis, yeah. I had a couple more months, which to me is more streets won't forget as opposed to one-hit wonders.
If memory serves correct, I think Giannis was eligible for 6 different nations for international duty, and there was this big clamber. Oh, he could play for England! He could save England! And yeah, he didn't do that.
Like, I remember that. I remember, like, his contract only had, like, a year or two left on it. It was, should they give him a 5-year deal or a 6-year deal? And it was just like, he is definitely going to be the guy. And now the streets won't forget, but Manchester United certainly has.
Yeah. And I've got another couple, if you'll indulge me, Tay-Tay. Mm-hmm. A name we've mentioned before on a Listen to Questions episode, Michu.
Mm-hmm.
Michu
of Swansea. I was wondering if he would come up.
Because he's streets won't forget and sort of flash in the pan and one season wonders. There's kind of a lot of overlap here, I think. Mm-hmm. And Michu maybe falls into all 3 categories. When he first came to Swansea, it was 2012-13. He got 18 goals in the league, 22 overall that season in Michael Laudrup's team. Was something of a phenomenon. And then the following season, he scored 2 goals. And then he disappeared out of sight.
That seems to be a trend with Swansea, because I would say the other one that just comes to mind for them would be Bafétimbi Gomis, who comes in, like, I think he says he familiarized himself with the club playing Football Manager, that he knew nothing about them. He does the Puma celebration, scores some goals, now is in Saudi Arabia, I think before that, Turkey. But again, another player who briefly, similar to Michu, we thought, like, oh, he's scoring goals, he's leading the line, it's this kind of promising, exciting team, and then it really wasn't meant to be. But yeah, I think Michu, like, is in a number of different categories when it comes to players that won't be forgotten, one-hit wonders, beautiful men who scored goals, all of these things.
I'm blanking on the name of the striker who Swansea sold to Man City, and he didn't do much at Man City. He cost $25
million. Oh, and he sang his own name. Oh, that's going to annoy me.
But while we're thinking of that, another player who was sold to Man City for a lot of money, Benjani from Portsmouth.
Yes.
Remember him?
Yeah,
sort
I do
of
remember
two,
him.
Late 2000s. Was sort of phenomenal at Portsmouth, and oh yeah, he's gonna got this big move to a big club. He did. He went to Man City for £8 million, and I don't know what he did there. I don't think he played soccer.
Yeah, I think he was in that time period where they were just like splashing money trying to sign whomever they could to show that they meant business.
Yeah, so this was sort of the period when they signed Robinho, and it was just when the new ownership group came in, and it was look what we can do, and that was one of their moves.
I need you to know, Wilfred Bony, there it is.
Oh,
it was
going to
drive me nuts this entire show, because I remember him singing his own, like, it was a very catchy song, and all I could remember for the longest time trying to remember his name was the Yaya song, because the Yaya Toure song is the best song there is. But yes, Wilfred Bony would be the other one. Yeah, a strong, proud history of Swansea having players that seem like they're going to do big things and then don't. Maybe the same goes for Swansea as well. Any other Streets Won't Forget players for you?
I have one more, but I've thought about it further, and I think it might be fraudulent. It was Teemu Pukki, I should say, from Norwich, coming in and sort of taking the Premier League by storm. It's not often that a striker can come up from the Championship and do so well, and he wasn't expected to do well, and he sort of came out the gate swinging with Norwich in the Premier League in that most recent Premier League season they had. So I thought that was a Streets Won't Forget, but then I actually realised there are divisions beyond the Premier League. Norwich are currently top of the Championship. He scored 11 goals this season already. He is not in the rear view just yet. He's the 4th top scorer in the Championship right now, so maybe a little more time and perspective before we put him in that category.
Weirdly, I agree with both of those things. I agree that it's like maybe harsh to put him in there and he's still doing things. But simultaneously, I think my takeaway from this is that it's not just that they scored a meaningful goal or they had a meaningful run of form. It's other little things that make them stand out. And for Teemu Pukki, number one, it's like Finnish striker with a fun name, but then also playing for Norwich and then scoring goals and like kind of couldn't stop scoring. Doesn't look like the most elite athlete at the same time. No disrespect intended. It's just, kind of balding, tall, kind of pale, does it like a little bit like awkward in his run, and yet still scoring goals. I think you have to have those little other elements that make them stand out. So I think Timu Pukki will be one who the streets will not forget, even if he continues to score goals and make it back to the Premier League and score goals there.
I felt seen when you were making that description of a man who kind of runs and going slightly bald and pale. It felt like you were describing someone in this conversation. Anyway, but then you mentioned scoring goals, and then I knew it wasn't me.
Exactly, exactly. That was the big difference there. But I really did enjoy that question, even if I did not know the phrase heading into it. But thank you to Patrick for that one. Thank you to Sean McNamara for the next question. It's an interesting one because I had like an immediate answer like, eh, and then I thought more about it and it gets a little bit more nuanced. So I'm excited for Ryan's answer. Sean asks, Weston McKennie for Paul Pogba in a straight up swap. Who says no? Manchester United, Juventus, neither or both. And who should say no?
I think Mino Raiola says no for a start. that'll be Paul Pogba's agent.
Oh man, that is a good and depressing answer.
We know that Mino Raiola makes a lot of money from player transfers, and we know that he made an awful lot of money when Paul Pogba went to Manchester United. Was it like 19 million? It was some really big, absurd number that he made of commission from Pogba's most recent transfer. So if it was a swap and there was no money involved, I think Mino would have a thing or two to say about that. I think if there was another category of people who would say no, it would be the Man United board.
I agree.
Ed Woodward would also say no. If you look on Transfermarkt right now, Transfermarkt, Paul Pogba's value is $71.5 million. Weston McKennie's is $21.5 million. You will note that one figure is significantly lower than the other. So in monetary financial terms, doesn't make a lot of sense. I've got a few more yes and no's for this one, but I'll hand over the reins for now, Taylor.
I will try to keep this one on track because sometimes when it's Manchester United related, the rambling begins. I will say that I'm with you, that I think it is not even with the American market aspect of things, I think it's not enough to justify that difference in valuation. And I think it also would then mean, it pretty much means that Paul Pogba was a failure at Manchester United. If you do that sort of swap deal, it's a very, I don't know how to pronounce the word, ignominious, whatever it is. Like, it's a very inglorious departure if you're going from this record signing to, oh yeah, it's a swap deal for a player who's worth not even a third of your value. But I also think,
you pronounce it, by the way, it's ignominious.
I love you, Ryan. I really do. But I think, like, if you look at it, though, from what Manchester United have done on the field, what Paul Pogba has not done on the field, you have Van de Beek maybe there to replace him if and when he does move. Weston McKennie feels like a good understudy, potential deputy, potential replacement. Like, so it does make sense in terms of what Weston McKennie could be for that team to some extent. I just don't think Manchester United would ever be okay with the optics on that one.
Yeah, and I had to think about this from both clubs' perspective as well. If I was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I think I'd be inclined to say yes to this deal,
right?
Because
it's weird.
He probably is aware that Paul Pogba, not entirely happy at the Manchester United setup, probably wants out from the evidence we have. He's had 9 Premier League starts this season. He was unused as an unused substitute in the League Cup semi-final against Manchester City this midweek. Apparently, there was a League Cup semi-final with Manchester City this week. There was other things on my mind on that particular Wednesday.
Yep.
I didn't catch the game, actually. But then, if you look at where McKennie would fit into that Man United team, would he be in that Scott McTominay middle role, do we think? Or where would he fit?
I think he'd be in that number 8, like the shuttler between a number 6 and a number 10. It is a very Manchester United thing to make a big sort of swap, make a big transfer for a player that doesn't really fit the current system or is like surplus to requirements in the current system. Because I think he'd play where Pogba plays, where Van de Beek plays. So there'd be another player coming in to play a role where you already have somebody. Maybe they would try him at that number 6 because I think Solskjaer, to your point, would like the tenacity. He would like the fight. He would like the energy of Weston McKennie, and maybe he could use him that way. I don't know about his passing ability, though it has gotten better. I don't know if he would be good enough or defensively oriented enough to do that number 6 job. But I think he'd be in that midfield somewhere. I'm confident with that one.
So I'm not sure if it would work from a Manchester United perspective on the playing field. And then if you look at Juve, yes, he had a great amount of success at Juventus, did Paul Pogba. But Weston McKennie's doing rather well there now, coming off the bench to get a goal in the win over Milan midweek. That's a big result for Juventus. And if you're Andrea Pirlo, I don't know if he cares, because I'm not convinced he cares about anything. I think he's too laid back to care about literally anything. But that's another conversation for another day. But, you know, he's got players like Rabiot, like Bentancur, and McKennie, who he uses a lot. So what would it be like, a middle of Artur, McKennie? Only you couldn't have McKennie and Pogba because they'd be swapped. No, right. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he'd want to lose McKennie and gain Pogba, if that would be a net gain for Juventus, given the uses that McKennie has at the moment.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair point. And then I think from the salary standpoint, Juve, obviously a big club with a decent amount of money, but as we saw with that Artur Pjanic swap, not the most money. So I don't know if they would love the salary. I feel like it would require Man United paying some of Paul Pogba's salary, which I don't think they're ever going to do. So there's that financial part to it. And then there is, like I'm sure this isn't what Sean necessarily was looking for, but the reality is it's worth remembering Weston McKennie is on loan at Juve right now, so it would require them making that deal permanent to then move him to Manchester United. So it would also require a little bit of logistical work, and maybe that's another reason why Juve would say no, though I'm sure they wouldn't mind having Paul Pogba and Cristiano Ronaldo playing together.
Indeed.
All right.
So we're agreeing that this shouldn't be done, right?
Yeah, it should not be done. I think my answer remains Manchester United would probably say no more strongly, and I think both would probably end up saying no, but also both would maybe consider it for longer than we might think. That's my sort of general answer.
Taylor Rockwell, the Manchester United fan, I think would make the swap, wouldn't he?
Taylor, the Manchester United fan, would absolutely make that swap, which is a strange thing to say. I love me some Paul Pogba. I just don't always love me some Paul Pogba. That's how I'll phrase that one. We've got more listener questions to come, but before that, let's have a word from today's sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help you find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn, though, isn't just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Speaking from experience, hiring for a small business, it's difficult when you're wearing so many hats. You might not have the time or the resources to hire. LinkedIn makes it very easy to complete the job hiring process. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. Comes very well recommended from this guy. And also 2.5 million small businesses who are using LinkedIn for hiring. On LinkedIn, did you know 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours? That's a quick turnaround to hire professionals on LinkedIn. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you.
And we are back. Mr. Bailey, why don't you ask the next question, since I believe it is intended for me?
Hang on, what question are we talking about here? Oh, I know the question exactly, the one. Excuse me, I'll look at the running order. It's from Ira Jersey. Hello, Ira, how are you doing today? Good to hear from you. A personal question he directs at your good self, Mr. Rockwell, but offers that anyone else on this podcast can answer too, and maybe I'll chip in here and there.
Please do.
If Manchester United win the League Cup, question out of date, asterisk, and make the Champions League, would you consider that a successful season? So I'm going to interpret that as, if Manchester United win a cup and make the Champions League, finish in the top four, would you consider that a successful season for this Manchester United team? I've got thoughts. I will cede the floor to the intended answerer of here. I've been watching too much of the Senate and the House. I'll stop talking like that. Have your answer now. Go on.
I shall. I would say this obviously was submitted before Manchester United were eliminated by Man City in the League Cup, as Ryan mentioned. I also watched that game, and it was the least I've ever cared about Manchester United losing a derby because, yes, bigger things were happening. But I will say, even if they had won that one, I really – it's harsh. I do not care about the League Cup just because of – what it is, the limited prize money, how long it was, the competition where smaller teams maybe took it seriously, larger teams played their academy players. It seems like yesterday, I think both teams played pretty strong sides, but I still have a hard time getting, like, no one is bouncing their grandchild on their knee talking about a League Cup win. So I think for me,
have you spoken to many Tottenham fans lately?
Well, there is that. Few people are doing it. So I think that wouldn't have been as big of a factor for me. I think you're wisely switching it to A Cup, so that could be Europa League, it could be the FA Cup. I honestly cannot remember if they're still alive in the FA Cup. I think that probably. Yeah, I think if you win the FA Cup and you qualify for the Champions League, I think that's a successful season. I think if you qualify for the Champions League and win the Europa League, that's certainly a successful season. I remain, like, rooted in – I still don't fully know what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wants to do from game to game. I think he likes to play on the counter, but, doesn't necessarily know what to do when they have the ball against a bunkered team. And I think that remains, like, in my thinking, so it's hard for me to be like, yeah, it'd be great if they qualify for the Champions League, but are they playing better? Like, I think that's where I continue to have a little bit of a stumbling block. So I'm curious if you have thoughts on this one, Ryan.
For me, if Manchester United win a cup and make the Champions League, hard yes, successful mm-hmm. season. There's yep. no, I can't see any other way of interpreting that question, frankly, because silverware is what we, you know, what a fan wants to, from a fan perspective, that's what you want your team. You want mm-hmm. your team to get to finals. You want your team to win things. That's great. Making the Champions League is what the boffins who write the checks want. That's what Ed Woodward wants when he's not swapping Weston McKennie for Paul Pogba.
Obviously.
So I think that has to be deemed a success. A trophy is success. Qualifying mm-hmm. for the Champions League is success. That's double success, maybe. I'll go for that. And particularly in this weird season that we're having, this weird year we're having, where there's more parity, where there's mm-hmm. more wonkiness between the teams, increased competition. This is a team that hasn't had a trophy in the last two seasons, am I right? I think no trophies last season. I think the mm-hmm. season before that didn't even get into the Champions League, if I'm remembering my Man United seasons correctly. You go back to the last one I consider a super successful season. That would be Jose Mourinho when he won the Europa League. Yep. Did he get the League Cup that season as well?
Maybe. Probably, because that feels like a thing he would celebrate, and then I think finished second that season as well.
I think that was actually the season before he finished second, and then he finished outside the Champions League that season.
You're right.
So even so, I'd still consider that a success because he won a major European trophy and the one that we've established mm-hmm. is not as important but still is a piece of silverware. But I think I would even argue you could call it a successful season this season to finish in the top four, given how crazy it is.
I think it's always a difficult, like, not difficult, just a strange thing when this question gets asked about a team that are currently in the top four. Because normally it's like Manchester United in seasons past have been like 6th or 7th or 8th or even further down. Earlier this season when you're in like 13th, if you ask me if they finish top 4, is it a success? I say yes. Now that they're in the top 4, it's a little bit like, well, they're already there. So is it like if the season ends right now, is it a success? I don't know. But I think that's probably a little bit too nuanced. I think to your point, if you make the Champions League and you're in that next season, that means a lot of money. That means a lot of prestige. It means you're still able to sign some players that maybe you otherwise wouldn't be. Yeah, I think it is probably a success. I still have some concern. I'm not like joyously celebrating it, but I'm quietly enthusiastic that they've made it to the Champions League. Certainly more so than I would be if they had won the League Cup. If they won the League Cup and didn't make the Champions League, I am definitely more disappointed than not winning the League Cup and qualifying for the Champions League.
Right, right. I mean, overall, if the PE teacher wins a trophy, that's got to be a success, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I hear your disrespect, and it hurts feelings. Let's move to another one. Let's move to Robert Cordova, who asks, where does Paolo Rossi rank in the importance of Italian football? Paolo Rossi passing away earlier in December at a relatively young age. I'd say like 62, I think he was, or early 60s. But Italian, I don't know if I would say legend, and maybe that's the place to start. But famed Italian goal scorer, helps them win World Cup glory, wins lots of other things, but also a little bit of a controversial figure as well.
Yeah, I think I'll say it from the start. I think he has to be considered a legend because his sort of moment in the sun was the 1982 World Cup final. He mm-hmm. he was golden boot in that competition. He scored 6 goals. He was the golden ball winner. He won the Ballon d'Or that season as well. He scored in the final. He scored the first goal of the World Cup final over over West Germany. So led Italy to a World Cup title. They hadn't won the World Cup previously. Their last win was 1938 before
it's a,
that.
It's a while ago.
Yeah.
Flip the numbers around. There you go.
A long old gap. And that was a big, big cathartic, huge moment for Italy. You know, not least beating the Germans 40 years after, or not long, relatively speaking, after the whole political unpleasantness which occurred in Europe at that time. So, and also, like in the UK, it was a time of sort of social and political unrest in Italy as well. So it was a very important moment for them. And, you know, as you mentioned, he was a controversial figure. It was the season before, or the season leading up to that World Cup, where he was banned for match fixing, I believe.
2 years.
Was it? Yeah.
2 years.
And he only just... And I think he only just came back into sort of the professional game not that long before that World Cup, a couple of months beforehand, if I'm right. But I think, he, you know, he's not, I don't think he's a Del Piero. I don't think he's a Baggio. I don't think he'd be remembered for his unbelievable silky skills. Mm-hmm. But he was a legend for basically carrying, or maybe not the right term, but leading Italy to that very, very important World Cup win that they had at that point. And I'll draw a parallel with England because that is my want. Jeff Hurst. Jeff Hurst, who scored the hat-trick in the 1966 World Cup final. He, you know, he got a knighthood, as many of those England players did. He will be forever lauded. There'll be statues of him for all of time in England. He wasn't England's starting striker. That was Jimmy Greaves, who actually, weirdly, got hepatitis, and he wasn't fully fit for the 66 tournament. But he was the star striker for England at that time. Jeff Hurst, who played for West Ham, was sort of drafted in almost at the last hour. He didn't even play the whole tournament for England. So he's another example of a player who will forever be a legend, even though he wasn't like the man in the team, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm glad you answered first, because I think I sort of forgot the question being, where does he rank in the importance of Italian football? And I think I was looking at, like, the quality, is he the most famous player? And I think you've said it correctly, which is he's not really. And I think part of that is because he doesn't do some of the things that, like, even Gattuso does or Pirlo does. Like, he's a very good goal scorer. What I kept seeing and watching him play was a little bit like an early Inzaghi. Like, he's very good at beating a line, about getting on the end of a ball, some opportunistic finishes. The hat trick against Brazil in the 82 World Cup. One of those is a good, like, header at the back post. He makes a smart run. One of them is he intercepts a wayward pass from a Brazilian player, gets around a defender, shoots, and scores. One of them is, like, redirects one that was going off frame onto frame and scores. And it's sort of, like, right time, opportunistic, but it's also that element of when you do it so consistently, it stops being like, oh, he just happens to be in the right place. And instead, it's like he always finds a way to be where he needs to be. So I think there's that element to it. I think also that he retires, I think, at the age of 30 due to accumulated injury. Then there's the match-fixing scandal, banned for 2 years, as you mentioned. So I had him as, like, a weird combination of Inzaghi, like Owen Hargreaves for what could have been if he had stayed fit, and Pete Rose, the baseball player who was banned for betting on his own games or betting on games but not betting against his team. I forget what the nuances are there, other than that Pete Rose thinks he shouldn't be banned and the various commissioners of baseball do. So I think those three things rolled together. I guess Inzaghi, Hargreaves, and Pete Rose is a little bit of a legend. So I think in the importance of Italian football, for what he represented, for not winning the World Cup but then also winning silverware with Juve at club level, I think, yeah, he's probably up there, but in terms of importance, he's probably not the most important. I'm going to put him in the second wave of important Italian players.
Yeah, and you touched on the domestic stuff there, two Scudetti with Juventus and the European Cup in 85 with Juventus, on the one against Liverpool with the Heysel disaster, incidentally.
Yeah.
If you were to rank or list the top 10 Italian players, you know, you'd have your Maldinis, your Pirlos, your Franco Baresi, your Del Pieros, your Baggios. Exactly. I don't think Paolo Rossi makes that list, but Robert's question was the importance and that sort of cultural importance as well as sporting importance. I think it's huge.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, it, up there, I think, is the consensus. And then I think Ryan has him a little higher than I do. But I think, yeah, you're sticking with the importance aspect, and I think that's the way to be. So let's go with Ryan's answer on this one. Let's see if Ryan has an equally wise answer for Drew Jordan's question. Why are there not more trades in European soccer, particularly in the Premier League? The example Drew gives, Dele Alli is sitting on the bench wasting time and collecting paychecks at Spurs. Couldn't Spurs benefit from trading him somewhere and getting a player in return, a quality player in return? Are there league rules that make trades more difficult, or is it difficult to coordinate trades between leagues? I would guess that Brexit has made that more complex as well, says Drew.
Why are there not more trades in European soccer? My answer, my short answer, Tete, is for the same reason that I don't use magic beans to barter at the market for my food. I use money. Money is a far significant, far better way of doing this. It's basically, that was a bit of a facetious answer, but it's because European clubs don't have to trade.
Right.
There's a transfer system that relies on sort of, you know, liquid cash, which is a much better way of doing things. And obviously, you know, with the North American system where players' contracts are with the league rather than the team. Is that correct?
This is the key thing, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously with each team in Europe being an individual entity and it's not just a case of where in North America you would switch registrations for a player, there is a financial and a contract angle to it as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think a swap, a trade would happen easily, or more easily, if both players were out of contract and you deem them to be of equal value mm-hmm. and an importance to either respective side. But I just think that's so rare that that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
It's just much, much easier to buy a player and then, you know, sell someone to somewhere else. It's just, you know, the free market, it's much easier to do it that way.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think with the free market, that's a key one there because, yeah, to your point, it's not like in the NBA where the contract moves with the player. Same thing with baseball, same thing with the NFL. If they've got a deal, they've got that deal until they sign a new one. With soccer, European soccer, and I think global soccer, aside from MLS and a few other leagues, that contract does not move. So if you wanted to do that trade, you then have to negotiate with the player, which means you then have to like hope that they're on a similar wage or that both players are okay with the move. That's another big part of it, is that inevitably, unless it is like Real Madrid trading with Barcelona or Barcelona trading with Bayern Munich, there's going to be one player leaving for a perceived smaller club. That's going to make it a harder thing to have happen when you don't have that kind of closed system where everybody's theoretically of the same level. And then just, I think another aspect of it is just that it's rare that you're going to want to get rid of a player like Spurs, are okay with getting rid of Dele Alli, let's say, for a swap deal. But in terms of finding a club that want Dele Alli and then have a player that Spurs also want, I think it's such a rare thing to have that combination. Even when you do like Mkhitaryan moving to Arsenal, like it still requires a lot of negotiation and wage structuring and balancing things. And it just becomes a very difficult situation that even then isn't really a swap deal, even though it's labeled as such, because you have so much money involved and salaries and all that type of thing. So I think in the end, to Ryan's point, it's just easier to buy somebody and sell the player than find a swap that works for every single person and the players will agree to and the agents will agree to your earlier point about Mino Raiola.
Well, that's another thing. The system, it wouldn't really work for agents having swaps mm-hmm. like that. The agents wouldn't get their fees and if there's no cash involved. And I think also maybe there's an element of player power as well in sort of the North American system where, or certainly in other North American sports, it's like, hey, you're getting traded to a city 2,000 miles away tomorrow. See you later.
See ya.
That doesn't really happen with European teams or even teams outside of North America elsewhere because the players have a bit more say on their destiny. But I think you hit the nail on the head there, Taylor, in that it's not often that trades will be mutually beneficial between two teams where the attributes that one player would bring to another team and vice versa would be exactly mirrored. I think that's just it would be the turn of events for that to happen would be very unlikely. And swaps have happened. The big one that springs to mind is Samuel Eto'o and Zlatan between Inter and Barcelona, but there was cash involved in that deal. And another one which sprung to mind as well was Jozy Altidore and Jermaine Defoe between Sunderland and Toronto. That was a swap, but there was also cash involved in that one. It's not just a, hey, I'll have him and you have him. It was still, I think, my understanding is that they were still separate cash transactions, but just happened to happen at the same time between those two teams.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised with that in mind that there are more swaps proposed than we probably hear about. There are more, I wouldn't even say trades, just like swap of one player for another proposed. And then I think you either get a like, well, not for that amount of money or not for this. And then you get that sort of like, yeah, we'll do that, but you've got to pay us another $2 million or something. Or it becomes the jumping off point for like, no, we kind of want to keep that player, but we are interested in the player you're selling. Or we don't want the guy that you want, but we don't want the player you're offering. And it becomes a sort of starting point for negotiations. But I think player movement is the big one. I think it's totally fair for a player playing in London to not then suddenly want to wake up in an Eastern European league or Russia or China. I think you've got to like be able to have a little bit of control over your own destiny. Whereas with the NBA, There's a limited number of top-tier NBA teams or basketball teams in the world, all of them playing in North America, I would argue. So I think it makes it more okay, even if sometimes the distance that a player is traded in the NBA is significantly further than a player moving from Spain to Germany would be.
Yeah. We don't have a barter economy, Tay-Tay. We don't need trades.
We do not. What we do have is more sponsors to get to, so we'll take a break to hear from them, and then we'll be back with our final two listener questions of the day. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. We are back with more listener questions. Ryan says we have three remaining. Have I missed one, or has Ryan forgotten to move his order around? Ryan, now there's two. The first one, the penultimate question, comes from Zach Lippert. Zach, apologies in advance if I misunderstood your question. We shall see. The question was, with Schalke hurtling towards the record for longest winless streak in Germany, I believe they would overtake Tasmania Berlin. I know nothing about Tasmania Berlin. Zach asks, what are famous bad records that clubs are proud of? And that's the part that I think is a little confusing, at least for me it was, because there are famous bad records, but in terms of bad records that clubs or fans then celebrate, that is a little bit more of a challenge. Ryan, what did you make of this question? Were you able to find some that teams or fans or whomever are proud of, they boast about being bad?
I don't think so, but what I could sort of build into is the English tendency to be joke about being negative about oneself, to be self-deprecating and to be deprecating about the team that one supports. And that led me to looking into the kind of streaks that the England team have gotten into. And they had the longest, I believe, penalty-less streak of any team. They went 53 games. This is a Guardian test your knowledge. I found the answer to this on in the end. They went 53 games without being awarded a penalty. That was 4.5 years worth of games. They scored one in February 86. That was Brian Robson who scored that one. They didn't get one again until the World Cup quarterfinals of Italia 90 against Cameroon. And in that game, Gary Lineker scored 2 penalties. So they came along all at once in that one. So that was the sort of one example I could think of, oh, we never get penalties, which you could kind of sort of be a knock on yourself. The other one which I thought I would bring up is the Bella Gutman curse, which I don't know if it's necessarily celebrated, but it's kind of folklore-y, isn't it? And to remind...
That's a good call. Yeah.
Yeah. So to remind the listeners a little bit of that, it's Bella Gutman, who was a very, very successful manager with Benfica. He won 2 consecutive European Cups in the early 60s. He kind of asked for his terms to be changed. Benfica said, do one, and he said words along the lines of, your team will not win a European competition in 100 years, and sounding like the Count from Sesame Street for some reason. And and Benfica have since been in 8 European finals. They have lost all 8, and they've got another 40-something years until the curse is lifted there. So that's not necessarily something that the team are proud of, but it's very much in the lore of the team.
The Bella Gutman story, the curse, but also his just general story, like, is similar to a Viking saga or like a Homeric poem or something like that. Of like, it's so many, like, that could not have happened. And yet it did, but you're not sure if it really did. Like, the story of him finding out about Eusebio while getting a haircut, like, his barber knew a scout or something like that. And it was like, yeah, I heard about this guy. He's really good. And Bella Gutman was like, well, I'll go watch him. Like, it's just so many strange stories like that. But you're right that it is so baked into, like, the Benfica history that, you're right, it's not one that they're celebrating. You don't have fans like, woo, curses! But it is such a part of it that it is a thing that is almost, like, institutionalized, at least in my mind. So I think that's probably the best answer. Well done, Mr. Bailey. Well done.
Thanks! You got anything?
My only club one I had, and it's not celebrated by the club, but it seems to be, like, an accepted thing would be that Cruz Azul is bad. I saw this on an ESPN article from Diccionario Popular. Cruz Azuliar is to fail at anything in any moment when everything is in your favor and you think nothing can ruin it. since 1997, Cruz Azul has finished runners-up 6 occasions. They've gone through 14 head coaches. They basically just find ways to lose titles, to lose championships in dramatic ways. I think the biggest one, I think it was against Club America, they're up 2-0 in the 88th minute. They go on to give up 2 goals in regulation. They lose in a penalty shootout. And it's extended to Mexico fans do not like Cruz Azul jerseys being worn to national team games. And in 2014, the story goes, they went so far as to give their opposing fans, their opposition in the World Cup fans, Cruz Azul jerseys. So there was like a photo of a Germany fan being given a Cruz Azul jersey. Mexico then beat Germany. There's a photo of, I believe, South Korea's manager's son wearing a Cruz Azul jersey. I'm assuming that was a gift for the World Cup. Then Mexico beat South Korea. So I think like that was a sort of one of like a team being so bad that the other fans of the national team enjoy using them to curse other teams. That was one that I think sort of fits the bill, though not entirely.
That's the best answer, I think. That's better than the Gutman answer, I think. That's really good because national team fans are proud of Cruz Azul's awfulness.
Yes.
I like that a lot.
Another national team one would be, it comes from, did you find yourself, by the way, just going through the knowledge on The Guardian to see if any questions like this had been asked? Because I definitely did. I went through about 30 different The Knowledge posts.
Yeah, that's where I got my England penalty list streak from, yes.
This one came from that one. In Denmark, a rigtig Jesper Olsen, a real Jesper Olsen, refers to an egregious mistake in any walk of life. It stems from his notorious back pass at the 86 World Cup, which led to the most exciting team in the competition being beaten 5-1 by Spain. So I had that one as a sort of, I guess, celebrating Jesper Olsen's mistake and adding it to your vernacular. I'm going to throw in there. I did have some just like bad records, if that's what Zach was wondering, asking about. But Ryan, any other nominees for this one before we move to that sort of area?
I also have bad records, so why don't you go first?
I just had two. The worst one being Derby County, 11 points in the 2008 season, one win in a year, earliest relegation ever for the Premier League. I believe that was in March. They do
well,
not...
Sheffield United very much hold my beer on that record at the moment.
Uh-oh. They do, right?
They're on course for like 5 points, I think, at the moment.
Oh, we shall see. We shall see. I didn't think about that. Oh, man. But like, yeah, I wondered if there was a like home of the worst team ever or like, and that is the thing is that even if maybe fans are going to own some of this sort of, not glorious history, clubs are never going to like really celebrate failure. And they're also, I then wondered if they were like spite statues. Ryan's got his finger in the air, so I'm going to pause here. Go ahead.
Derby play at Pride Park and they are proud of their record. We've got
the
answer.
There we go. Ryan did it. Ryan connected the dots. Thank you, sir. I don't know if you did this as well. I was wondering if there are like statues or banners that commemorate negative moments, like the Gerrard slip or something like that, or like fans celebrating another player scoring that eliminated their rival, or like two teams were level on points, one team wins, another player knocks out the other team, and so they win on like by a small points difference. But there's not really any of that either.
Wasn't there a Zidane headbutt statue at some point?
Ooh, that should be a thing. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was. You're right. Yeah. I think you're right. Oh, don't make fun of Zidane or his family. We still don't really fully know what that one was, right?
Something like that. It wasn't great. Either way, it shouldn't be celebrated.
It should not. And then the only other one I had from England would be Hull City are currently in the longest drought in the English leagues. They have not won silverware since winning the third division in 1966. Yes, they went up in the Premier League, but I believe that was like as a second place team or maybe through the playoffs. Although if they'd won the playoffs, then they would have won silverware. So still no silverware for Hull City since 1966, and Derby County's very, very bad, no good season in 2008. Also, maybe records that the clubs are not proud of.
I've got a couple of English ones to finish off this question with. Everton had the most own goals in Premier League history, 53 in 29 seasons. Wow. They also have the most missed penalties. They've missed 8 Premier League penalties. And they've had 110 given against them as well. The other one I'll single out is a player, Richard Dunn, who's had he's the biggest Premier League own goal scorer. Richard Dunn has scored 10 own goals. He scored 6 for Manchester City alone. And he also is infamous for having the most red cards, the joint most red cards in Premier League history. He had 8 red cards, which is not exactly Sergio Ramos levels, but hey, he's maybe the Premier League equivalent thereof. One other one, there's a team called MK Dons. They've got the record for the most games being an absolute disgrace to football. It's every game consecutively since they were founded in 2004.
I knew we'd get it in there somehow. I just wasn't sure how. I knew there'd be an MK Dons shot at some point. Well, well executed, Ryan Bailey. The other one, I forget their name. It's a Madagascar team. They're like Stade. It sounds like Marseille, as I recall. It's like Stade Olympic something. But it's a Madagascar team who scored 149, I think it was, own goals in a game to protest their treatment by their club. They scored that many own goals. That's a fairly notorious record. I did look up to see if there's any sort of banner commemorating that, any sort of statue commemorating player solidarity against ownership. I did not find one. Then again, there was not a ton of information on the Madagascar League.
There you go.
Shocker, shocker. Much more information on the Madagascar film franchise.
And on that animated note, Tate, let's go to one final question from Joshua Bishop, who asks, at what point will Hansi Flick be considered in the echelon of Pep, Klopp, Jose, etc.? Seems to me, says Joshua, people discuss top managers in the world and they leave him out. Given where he's taken this Bayern team from what they were and his success with the German national team, I feel, says Joshua, that he should be given more credit. Was denken Sie, Taylor? Was denken Sie?
I think he probably is given a lot of credit. He probably could be given more for turning around Bayern. In terms of like when will he be considered in the top echelon, I think not necessarily anytime soon unless Bayern continue to do what they've been doing over a couple more seasons. Because, yes, he has success with the German national team, but it's not him as the manager and then moving to Bayern as the senior manager. He's the assistant for Yogi Löw. Löw is the same thing with Klinsmann, but I think then it was like Löw is the genius, Klinsmann is the motivator. Then Löw was the kind of genius for Germany when Germany won the World Cup, and Hansi Flick was like also a genius, but not the genius behind the scenes. So I think he needs a little bit more on that resume. What say you, Ryan Bailey?
I think I'm going along the same lines there. Yes, he has arguably built the best team in the world, but you know he had some pretty good building blocks to start with there. He did win the he did not win the FIFA best coach best award. Jürgen Klopp getting that despite winning a treble with Bayern Munich. He was German coach of the year though, and as you mentioned, he did a lot of good work with the German national team as Yogi Löw's assistant. He was there from 2006 to 2014, so very much quite literally the rebuild of the German national team he was there for. I don't know 100% what his duties were. I suspect part of it may have been carrying hand sanitizer for Yogi Löw for whenever his hands went either up his nose or in his pants.
Yogi.
That's quite possible. But he it's interesting if you compare him to someone like Klopp or Guardiola. I think there's a difference in those kind of managers. Yes, Hansi Flick now has trophies in his cabinet, but he's not quite done the thing of establishing a philosophy and having sort of a cultural impact there. He does like a similar high press to Jurgen Klopp, you could argue, and there are things he does, but he's not changed the game like Jose did, changed the game like Klopp and Pep Guardiola have. He was sort of thrust into this position at Bayern Munich almost unwittingly with Niko Kovac's exit. And I think he needs to be considered in that band. He needs to have success in a more sustained period, so a few more trophies perhaps, and also have a mark on the game philosophically. Have something that you say, that's Hansi Flick's.
I think that is the fundamental point. I think you're absolutely correct, and that is the distinction there. Because, yeah, you look at Pep, Klopp, Jose, all players who I would say sort of revolutionized things, or even like with Pep, where he kind of played the way Barcelona have always played, but there's tiki-taka, he brings through academy players, he gets the best out of Lionel Messi. Like, he does so much to revitalize things, but revolutionize at the same time, and then obviously continues that with Bayern Munich and with Man City. And I think, like, if you're looking at Hansi Flick, who is an excellent manager and has done a great job, and I think what we're both trying to do is not dismiss or disparage Hansi Flick at all, but I would draw a parallel to Zinedine Zidane, who inherits a Madrid team after a manager is sacked, who's not as popular. That manager comes in. Zinedine Zidane wins three Champions Leagues in a row, and we still don't really think of him as the greatest manager in the world. He's not in that conversation really ever. It's always Pep, Klopp, Jose. And I think that sort of shows it right there. It's like, because you're given this team after being a sort of assistant manager for them, given is a harsh way to put it, but you understand what I mean. And then, yeah, you have success, but there's still that question of, is it just that you got the best out of a world-class group of players? Like, what are you doing to then elevate that? And I think you're absolutely right, that if he does that or they continue to win the way they are, then we can say, like, yeah, he is doing it. He is in that conversation. But right now, I think he's just on the outside.
I think just on the outside is about right. And I think the litmus test of it, Taylor, might be if there was a big Premier League job available at the moment, if the Chelsea job was available, would he be a prime candidate, even if he was free? Would he, if him and Thomas Tuchel were free, for example, who would be more heavily linked to a big job? I'm not sure it's Flick.
I'm not sure it is either. And part of that is because you know he's not going to leave Bayern. Like, why would you leave that gig? Only if you're Pep and it's been a while or you want to challenge yourself elsewhere. But I think also you're right that with Thomas Tuchel, he kind of continues the Klopp tradition, evolves it at Dortmund, goes to PSG, has the ability to manage big names, big egos. At least I think he does. So I think you're right. It's probably Thomas Tuchel is getting more interest around the world than Hansi Flick, even if Hansi Flick maybe deserves more interest.
It does indeed.
I think that's a perfect note to end on, sir.
Yes, it is.
What a good answer. Well done, Ryan Bailey. Anything else you'd like to discuss, Ryan, before we call it a day, other than the fact that I've called you by your first and last name like 16 times on this episode?
Oh, I enjoy it. It's an identifier, which very much picks me out of the crowd. I appreciate it, Tay-Tay.
You go Tay-Tay. You go informal. I go Mr. Ryan Bailey Esquire. So I go even more formal.
Well, that's what, you know, Michelle Obama said, when they go low, you go both names.
That is definitely what she said. Ryan Bailey, thank you very much for helping me answer some listener questions today. You and Graham Ruthven and myself will be back on Monday to do some weekend reviewing, if that works for you. I hope it does.
Jawohl!
Then all that remains to be said is, Ryan, thank you very much. Rai, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's always a pleasure, never a chore. My friends call me Risey.
Risey out. And listeners, thank you very much for listening. We will talk to you again very soon.